Good morning, everybody. I'm Rob Atkinson. I'm president of Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. This is our second event at this venue in the because we just moved here about 2 weeks ago, so we had one on Monday on health IT privacy. It's a great event, and the PowerPoint projector wasn't working, although the mic was working. Now the PowerPoint projector works, but we don't need it, but the mic isn't working, so I encourage everybody to speak loudly. So anyway, we want to welcome everybody here today. This, I think, should be a fascinating event to talk about, a very innovative and compelling proposal to essentially Stuart Benjamin and Artie Ray, who are professors at Duke Law School, have come up with. And it's an idea to create a more formalized process of reviewing federal efforts through a lens of innovation. And so I'm going to let them talk about the proposal that they have and how it would work and their views on how you would set this up. And then we'll hear from Steve Merrill and we'll also hear from Mike Nelson to give remarks. We'll end at precisely 10:30 unless everybody votes to go on through Twitter feeds, and then we can we'll do that. So I'll start with Artie Ray, who's an authority in patent law, administrative law, and biopharmaceutical industry. Her research currently is focused on innovation policies in areas such as green technology, drug development, and software, and funded by the NIH, Kauffman Foundation, and Chatham House. She has published widely in a wide array of journals, including Nature, Biotechnology, PLOS, Biology, and Medicine. And it's working. Beautiful. Thank you. She also serves as a peer reviewer for science, research policy, Journal of Legal Studies, and a whole wide array of other scholarly journals. She's testified in front of the Senate on policy, innovation policy issues, and she's currently chair of the Intellectual Property Committee of the Administrative Law Section of the ABA. Prior to coming into academia, she was clerked for the Honorable Marilyn Hall Patel of the U.S. District Court in Northern California, and was a litigation associate at Jenner and Block, has a degree from Harvard in biochemistry, magna cum laude, and a JD from Harvard Law School, also cum laude. Stuart Benjamin, I guess I can say you guys are also related by marriage.
It's not a secret.
It's not a secret. I wasn't sure if this was something.
Our daughters know.
Do they? Do your colleagues know? All right. Okay. Stuart is a JD in 1991 from Yale University. Before he began teaching law, he served as editor of Yale Law Journal, clerked for Judge William Canby at the U.S. Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit, and Justice David Souter at the U.S. Supreme Court. Also has an extensive law background. From 97 to 2001, he was associate professor of law at University of San Diego. More recently, before he came to Duke, he was the Rex G. and Edna Baker professor of constitutional law at University of Texas Law School. I'll introduce everybody now before we go on. Steve Merrill, most of you know Steve. Steve's a longtime colleague. He's the executive director of the National Academy's STEP Board, the Science, Technology, and Economic Policy Board. He's been that since its formation in 1991. I'm not going to read Steve's long background, but suffice to say Steve is one of the leading experts in Washington on science and innovation policy. He's been at the Academy since 1985. Before that, CSIS. Served on various congressional staffs, including Senate, Commerce, Science, and Transportation, and holds numerous degrees. Everybody here except me is cum laude. I'm just not sure I like that. All right. So Steve is cum laude at Columbia, at Oxford, Yale. Anything else I'm missing here, Steve? All right. Mike does not look to appear to be cum laude. That's good. Just a PhD in geophysics from MIT, but, you know, hey, anybody can do that. And then a BS in geology from Caltech. Mike, now, again, most of you should know Mike. Mike is, again, one of the leading innovation tech policy people in Washington. Mike now is at Georgetown, where he teaches courses and does research in a whole array of issues around IT policy, internet, cyber policy, and e-government. He was before that at IBM for a number of years, really, I think about 12 years, 11 years, where he really was the kind of key technology policy person here in IBM's Washington office. Before that, he was at Director of Technology Policy at the FCC, and before that, worked with Vice President Gore doing tech and IT policy in OSTP, and before that was on the Science Committee in the Senate. So a great panel today, and I guess we'll start off with Artie to make comments. I don't know if you want to, it's easier probably if you can come up here.
Sure, absolutely. So I really want to thank Rob for setting this up. These are fabulous digs you've got here. I told Rob that you live much better than academics do. So I want to start with a point that I hope is well recognized, at least in this audience, and that is innovation is really important. For example, and just to cite one reason, empirical studies by economists have shown that technological innovation, and specifically innovation in information and communications technology, was the key to productivity growth in the late 90s. More generally, studies have shown, from Rob Solow on, that innovation is the key to increasing productivity and long-term economic growth. It's also interesting to note how much innovation will be key to addressing the challenges that can accompany economic growth. For example, according to a recent estimate by the Joint Global Climate Change Research Institute, expected innovation in green technology is likely to reduce by $20 trillion the present value cost of stabilizing carbon dioxide levels at 550 parts per million. So innovation is important. I don't think I have to convince this audience of it, but just in case. Agencies are making innovation policy all the time, either consciously or unconsciously. In this case, as in all cases, there is no neutral position on innovation policy. You're doing it even if you don't know you're doing it. So our basic question in this paper is to ask whether it makes sense to have the goal of advancing innovation be explicitly on the agenda of agencies, not to the exclusion of everything else, obviously, but explicitly on the agenda so that it can be discussed and evaluated in the context of agency action. We think, given its importance, it should be placed on the agenda. Currently, in large part anyway, it's not on agencies' agenda, because oftentimes innovation is not in the interests of incumbent players. Disruptive innovation challenges their business models, so there's no reason for them to champion disruptive innovation. So we're talking about making room at the regulatory table for innovators who may not exist or have little lobbying power. Our suggestion is to force the regulatory process to consider innovation. Just a couple of examples, there are many more in the paper, of situations where agency policies have either ignored innovation or contradicted each other with respect to innovation. One example that we cite in the paper involves a lawsuit against the startup company Vonage, which provides VoIP telephony, voice over internet protocol telephony, which is something that the FCC has been promoting very vigorously in its own policy discourse. At about the same time the FCC was doing this, Verizon, Sprint, and AT&T filed suit against the startup provider of VoIP, one of the really only successful providers of VoIP, based on some broad and probably invalid patents. Because of the costs of litigating the invalidity of those patents, Vonage settled the lawsuits rather than incur the expenditures of litigating the validity, and it seriously damaged Vonage as a startup. In this case, patent policy on invalid patents, in all likelihood, conflicted with FCC policy. And the result was not sanguine for either Vonage or for our country more generally. Professors Katz and Shalansky of Columbia and now Georgetown, respectively, have pointed out the ways in which merger review is not dynamic. It doesn't take into account innovation possibilities. So we're shamelessly copying their article from 2007 in the Antitrust Law Journal in pointing out another area where agency policy ignores innovation. And then finally, last but not least, and again, this is just another of many examples in our paper, the FCC didn't even consider effects on innovation when it decided to issue what's known as the Broadcast Flag Order. This was an order that it issued, subsequently overturned as being outside its jurisdiction by the D.C. Circuit, but nonetheless it issued it, saying that digital devices that receive broadcast signals had to include restrictions against copying in the devices. There's a lot of reason to believe that that was not the best way to deter piracy. It was a very innovation-limiting way to deter piracy, and there would have been better ways to do it. Yet the FCC didn't even think about that when it issued the Broadcast Flag Order. So some of you might be thinking right now, look, we have a new administration in town, the Obama administration. It's made a lot of moves in the direction of innovation. It's specifically been very active in integrating new technologies into government processes. We have a new CIO position specifically for that purpose. We have an advisor in the State Department who's advising Hillary Clinton on how to use IT and Twitter and all of those great things to disseminate our message of global inclusion. That's all useful, but, and in fact very good, but has no necessary connection with increasing productive innovation in the economy. There are other Obama initiatives that are more specifically focused on increasing innovation in the economy. For example, a new CTO position just filled by Anish Chopra has been created. And that's all really great as far as it goes, but as many people in this audience probably know, it's very easy for issues to be talked about, but nothing actually gets done about them. Having people who care about issues in government is great, but they also need to have some power. And as far as we can tell, the CTO position, as well as certain positions that have been created in the National Economic Council and the Office of Science and Technology Policy, which has folks in it who care a lot about innovation, don't have a huge amount of power. In addition, OSTP focuses on science and technology policy. That's what it was set up by Congress to do, which is, in our view, quite distinct from innovation policy. Now, one coordinator that has had real power, and no one can gainsay this for better or for worse, is a little-known office within OMB called the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, or OIRA. It tells agencies how to do cost-benefit analysis, and then it reviews their cost-benefit analysis of major regulations, regulations that are likely to have more than $100 million of impact on the economy. It can effectively block regulations that don't comply with their view of how cost-benefit analysis is done appropriately. I think it's fair to say no one has ever complained that OIRA doesn't have enough power. So one might ask, why can't OIRA do this? Why can't it include dynamic effects, i.e. effects on innovation, into its cost-benefit analysis? That would be quite parsimonious and also arguably normatively attractive. Innovation is not the only goal one needs to factor into analyzing agency action. It's a very important goal, but it's not the only goal, obviously. So why not have innovation be part of this larger cost-benefit analysis? One problem is that over the past several decades, the career people at OIRA have been quite uninterested in innovation. Even though Executive Order 12866 specifically mentions innovation, the circular that they send out to agencies talking about how to do cost-benefit analysis says almost nothing about innovation. Even though there's a huge amount of economic work on how to model dynamic effects, the circular says precious little about innovation. In addition, OIRA tends to be reactive, not proactive, again, even though the executive order setting it up allows it to be proactive. And finally, last but not least, frankly, it's been perceived as anti-regulatory, and we don't want our innovation policy reviewer to be perceived as anti-regulatory because we don't think innovation cuts in either direction, pro-regulatory or anti-regulatory. It's just a really important issue. So we don't think OIRA is necessarily the only option or the best one. Still, the example of OIRA does tee up nicely the question of exactly how much power an innovation policy coordinator should have, because OIRA has been a coordinator that, again, for better or for worse, nobody can argue they don't have power and they haven't had a huge impact on the way that regulation is done in Washington, D.C. over the last 30 years or so. So that tees up my co-presenter, Stuart Benjamin, to talk about how an innovation policy reviewer should be set up, using the example of OIRA, perhaps as inspiration, perhaps as foil.
Can I ask folks who are in the back there, if you just want to come on in and sit down, there are a bunch of seats here. Maybe if you're on an edge, if you can move in, because there may be other folks coming, and there is a lot of room. So there's room right up in the front. There are lots of seats, so please come on in and sit down.
So while people are getting settled, so assuming that we care about changing innovation policy, it's obvious that there's no easy way to do this. There's no one simple magic bullet solution. We proposed the idea of an Office of Innovation Policy. We think it's a promising solution. Why this? Why have you couldn't hear me otherwise. All right. Why have an office dedicated to doing this? Well, it doesn't ask old agencies to learn new tricks. Now, we're not adding one more thing on to existing agencies and telling them, now you have something else you have to keep track of. For what it's worth, the record of agencies learning those new tricks is not a terribly comforting one. Agencies are supposed, for instance, to always have an impact statement that indicates the impact of their regulations on federalism. There's a study done in fewer than 1% of cases that where a federalism regulatory impact statement should have been issued, was it even issued? Much less did the agency seem to be taking it seriously. But also, this doesn't involve a remaking of the administrative state. Yeah, if we were creating the system all over again, maybe we would create a different set of agencies, and maybe we would create an agency that was just in charge of all forms of innovation, have huge powers, but we're not in that world. And one other advantage of having OIP do this, possibly within OIRA, or else on its own, is it doesn't fragment the analysis. So you have one entity that with ANILA can have a lot of expertise about innovation within it. Still raises the question of how much power you want that entity to have. And here is where, as Artie was suggesting, OIRA maybe is instructive. So on the one hand, mere hortatory power I just think is not going to do much good. That's why it's great to have the initiatives the Obama administration has had, but just being able to say to agencies, hey, this matters, that's just one more voice in the wilderness. On the other hand, the ability to permanently block regulations, effectively the power that OIRA has, you didn't do a good enough job, sorry, try again, is a huge power for any entity to have. And so our proposal instead is a middle ground. OIP would engage in innovation analysis of proposed agency actions and would have the ability to say to the agency, in effect, we're going to remand this back to you for reconsideration. Ideally, it wouldn't even get to that point. Please just take a hard look at our proposal in the first place. But if on remand, having sent this back to you, you still want to stick with your position, you're going to be able to stick with your position. Now, having said that, one advantage of having OIP is this now is part of the administrative record. So on review to a court, one of the questions a court would ask is, did you take a hard look at what OIP's input here? And so we think it'll have real impact without utterly bogging down administrative processes, without preventing agencies from being able to carry out their missions. So you might be wondering, well, how is this different from OIRA? And in terms of the power, in terms of the setup, well, this is less power than OIRA has, frankly. OIRA does have the power to block, and this is not a permanent blocking power. There's another difference also with OIRA, which I think is important to get on the table. For better or for worse, OIRA was created with an anti-regulatory agenda. That is, which has a clear conservative liberal valence. OIRA is always looking for less burdensome regulations, and it puts it in the position of being receptive to industry players who say, well, don't put this burden on us, it'll be a big hassle for us. We think that's less likely to be the case here, in part because innovation, by definition, we're looking at developments that haven't yet happened, entrenched industry players aren't as opposed. They don't have as much reason to be opposed with in entrenched positions, because the whole thing is the development hasn't occurred. They could be beneficiaries of it. Who knows? And so we aren't expecting the same kind of classic liberal conservative setup that we've seen with OIRA. And in fact, as we note in the paper, strikes us as quite plausible. In fact, this would be the ideal, that OIP would often say to agencies, here's one thing you're proposing. We think this will hurt innovation. Here's a different way of achieving that same goal. So more like prompt letters, which haven't really gotten off the ground for OIRA, but a prompting role that OIP could play. I do want to note a couple of other things, though, about OIRA, the way in which it's instructive. So a small entity with very small budget can have a very big impact. We think the same thing is true for an Office of Innovation Policy. And an Office of Innovation Policy could be part of OIRA. It could provide the innovation module for OIRA review, or it could be separate from OIRA, where there's different ways of setting it up, and we don't think there's only one way to skin that cat. And one other thing to note is that the Office of Innovation Policy could be involved early in the regulatory process. In fact, that's really the goal, is at the formulation stage to have the Office of Innovation Policy weigh in and say, well, listen, here are things we think would be good for innovation, so here are directions we think are promising to pursue. All right, so some people are going to object, but experts are often wrong. Of course they are. Of course we know that there are going to be mistakes made. The point is, are we better off having people whose focus is on innovation, who are trying to get it right, who actually have some expertise, rather than have it be just this side issue that's out there that never gets a focus, that never really has expertise trained on it? Similar kind of point, maybe good innovation is in the eye of the beholder, so why won't this just be yet another instance of everybody saying, oh, this is good for innovation, this is bad to innovation? There's something to that as well. But you know what? In some situations, we are going to agree that things are bad, you know, better or worse innovation policy. And even having the focus changes the terms of the debate. So pick your example of an agency that is focused on protecting some particular industry. I mean, often this is part of the agency culture. So I know a fair amount about the FCC, you know, protecting local television as an important agenda item for the FCC. That's just going to be a different focus than let's try to focus on what would be good for innovation. And there's no two ways about it. It's going to play out differently. And it's just not going to be the case that innovation policy is always going to be up for grabs. In some situations, we really will be able to say, gee, we understand there's a desire to help this existing industry, whatever it might be. In the long term, what we should really want is to try to have new innovative technologies coming forward, and simply protecting this industry is not going to be the best way to achieve that. And nobody who's not on the payroll of those companies is going to disagree. So again, back to the examples that Artie gave. There really were other ways of achieving the goals of protecting digital content other than the broadcast flag. The FCC just didn't focus on them as much as we think it should have. There really were other ways of trying to protect real innovations in the telephony space without giving what ended up being a blocking patent to AT&T, Sprint, etc., that would block Verizon. Now, having said all of this, another question you might have, but won't it still be the case that decision makers could, if they want to, act in bad faith and become these kind of crazy rogue operators who, A, stick their fingers in every pie, and B, badly? And the answer is, of course. Of course that's possible with any entity. Whenever you're setting up, you name the institution you want to set up. We could call it the Presidency of the United States, the Senate, any agency. Of course you can get people in there that you think will have the wrong priorities and do bad things. And you know what? If you get the wrong people in there, there's nothing we can do. We get 100 senators who are committed to Satanism. Guess what? We're going to have Satanism in this country. I mean, there's nothing I can do about that. I don't believe that, however... And if you believe the public choice story, then it doesn't matter what agency you ever create, powerful players are always going to win. I think empirically we've actually seen that isn't true. If the public choice story were right, then the switch of a Republican senator to a Democratic senator should make no difference in their votes in the Senate, because you have the same powerful interests in any given state. And yet we do see this switch their votes. Lots of predictions of the public choice story don't tell an accurate story. But if you believe that, again, that the powerful players are always going to win, then I suppose you should be fine with our proposal, because you think they're going to win anyway. So what does it matter? It's just one. Again, I think that misdescribes the actual world that we live in, and powerful players also think it misdescribes the world because they fight tooth and nail against various kinds of changes. So that goes to the final point, which is, how can this entity be created? Is this just pie in the sky because Congress will never get behind it? Well, it's probable that it would be hard to get all of the machinery going for Congress to enact it, but it doesn't have to be a congressional enactment. As we've proposed the powers that an OIP would have, it could be done via executive order. And we see that as a big advantage of this proposal. Because it's not going to have these huge new powers, this is something that is realistic both as a legal matter and as a political matter for the president himself actually to do. And so you don't have to get all of the machinery of legislation. It'd be great if it happened, but you don't need that in order to actually have an Office of Innovation Policy. And with that, because I want to hear from the commentators, I will stop. And I don't know which of the two. You know who's first.
Thank you very much. I first want to congratulate Artie and Stuart for bringing their administrative law expertise very creatively to this important subject, and Rob also for making a very lengthy law review article accessible to a wider audience. It's a real niche that Rob, among others, is filling in translating good academic work into terms that policymakers and policy analysts can deal with. The first premise of the paper, I think we all agree with, I'm sure a large majority of you do as well, namely that promoting innovation should be a national policy priority, that the government has a number of varied roles, including creating conditions for innovation, providing resources in some cases for innovation, and removing obstacles for innovation. So while I make my quibble with some of their terminology, some of their definitions, I soundly accept their underlying premise. Rather, I think there are two questions that should be asked about this proposition. And the first is, how far does it go? How far does the concept of an OIP for regulatory review take us in the direction of a robust innovation agenda and an institutional capacity to adjust innovation policy in the future, which is going to be a need on a continuing basis? Given that the proposal requires non-trivial resources and political capital, because it's, as the discussion has shown, is going to step on a number of toes. So should it have, if it has merit, which I think it does have some merit, Is it a matter of high priority, medium priority, or low priority? The second set of questions, which Artie and Stuart have addressed in some detail, are questions about whether it's feasible, how it would be set up, whether it's desirable in its own terms, how it relates to other institutions, and so forth. I think these are secondary points, and I'll list some of them. I think I'll list some that they have given less attention to than others, but I'm not going to go into detail. I'll leave that for Q&A discussion. So to answer the first question, it's worth thinking about the many references that have already been made to the progress the Obama administration has made in developing an innovation policy or policies at a time when it's remarkable how much else is on their plate. And it's also worth thinking about where they ought to be going in the future in order to determine if OIP is the most important missing piece of the pie. So let's look at personnel for a minute, which they refer to. There are a number of people with a variety of titles involving technology, involving innovation in the White House. There are new offices in the White House. And more interestingly, there are people now in the agencies with responsibility for innovation, not just state, but education, and a variety of other cabinet-level and independent agencies. I'm less concerned that Artie is about whether they have, particularly the people in the White House, have authority in a sort of statutory sense. Than I am about whether this apparatus that's been put in place is too fragmented. But the administration does recognize that this may be a problem. And they're dealing with it in two time-honored ways. One is creating interagency committees. For example, the innovation policy group that's chaired by Susan Crawford of the NEC. And by joint appointments, which I think is also very important, between the CTO and OSTP, between OSTP and the National Economic Council. So I am, one, content to see how this system works out over time. And I'd suggest that OIP doesn't help the tasks of policy development and policy coordination in the White House. It's rather going to be another unit with a very specialized function that has to be coordinated with a variety of other units. Secondly, let's look briefly at sectoral innovation policies. In IT, we have a very fairly robust agenda, which Rob and his group have helped articulate. In energy, we have at least two major pieces of the puzzle being implemented. One being subsidies to and support of research development and technology development, and even in some cases of alternative energy sources, production subsidies. And we have the prospect of a cap and trade system which will raise the price of carbon, which I think is equally important. In health, I think that's thoroughly murky. If you can tell me, except for IT applications, where innovation concerns figure in the health care reform debate, I'd be delighted to know. Fourth, services. 80% of the economy. I think we've just begun to think about what innovation and services mean and what the government's role should be. This was intended to come out of a study that was mandated in the Competes Act, but 3 years later it hasn't been funded. Let's look briefly at cross-cutting instruments. Research and development, the traditional government role in promoting innovation, and the easiest to conceive, and in some cases the easiest to implement. Yes, far more than we imagined they would, this administration has addressed research and development spending, not only on the side of the physical sciences and engineering, which have suffered for over a decade, but also in biomedical research, and not only in the stimulus bill, but in promises in future budgets, including their FY 2010 request. I say far more than we expected, because when my board chair, Larry Summers, spoke to the Academy on October 30th, he was saying not appropriate to use stimulus funding for research and development, because you get you can't ramp it up and then ramp it down. Measurement and statistics, very important. And what we've seen is a robust budget for the Bureau of Economic Analysis, which has the lead in implementing what I think is probably the most important and maybe only contribution of the last administration to innovation policy development, in the form of the Secretary's Advisory Report on Innovation Measurement. Not so sure that other important statistical agencies have the resources they need. For example, the Bureau of Labor Statistics. In taxes, we focused again on the R&E tax credit and not other aspects of the tax code. In intellectual property rights, there's been a vacuum pending the appointment of the PTO director and the intellectual property enforcement coordinator in the White House, who may or may not have policy responsibilities. So that, at least in the terms of the people being nominated, promises to be addressed, not entirely clear how. Standards, very little attention, and regulation, very little attention. So there's a lot to do here, and regulation's only a part of it. Fourth, robust analytical capability for moving forward. With the elimination of the Technology Administration and the Office of Technology Policy, this administration has pretty much of a clean slate in creating a capability to analyze what's needed over a sustained period of time. There are pockets of expertise represented here by NIST and in the Science and Technology Policy Institute, but it needs to be fleshed out, and that process, as far as I know, hasn't begun. So OIP would address only a small part of the innovation policy challenge, and in a narrow way. What do I mean by that? Well, I mean that OIP, like OIRA, it would not apparently set its own agenda. It wouldn't think how to revise regulation, how to even suggest changes in statutory frameworks for regulation. It would take regulations as originated in the agencies, in the regulatory agencies, as the basis for their actions. So there's not much opportunity to address, for example, what I think is a growing problem, and that's the doldrums in which pharmaceutical innovation is in. Now, questions about OIP in its own terms. I said I'd be extremely brief. I think they've done an adequate job of dealing with questions like role and authority, alternatives placement outside the executive office, centralization versus decentralization, and the method of establishment. I think we need to think a lot harder about questions like the methodology for an innovation analysis. I think they gloss over the fact that there is no agreement on what, much less than cost-benefit analysis, on what the methodology should be. They're pretty silent on staffing and resources and budget. And until I heard that it might go in OIRA, they were pretty silent on what the relationship to other White House entities is. So while the case hasn't been made, I think, yet, to create a freestanding OIP with the scope and authority of an OIRA, I would like to see the White House try out regulatory review in a number of contexts. And I'd start with the context in which the agency's mission is to promote innovation, not to control it, as it is in the case, for example, of the FDA. My example would be intellectual property, and particularly the patent office, an area, it happens, I've been done some work in. And the example is that the office is coping with a crushing workload and a growing backlog. And this past couple of years proposed regulations governing what you could submit in a patent application, how much you could submit, how often you could resubmit it. And they were roundly criticized by the patent-using community, in part because they said this would discourage innovation. Was there any analysis? No. Now, the courts threw out those regulations, in part, on the grounds that the PTO didn't have the authority. But as the new administration of the PTO comes in, I would suggest that any attempts to deal with their internal administrative problems will have a major effect on innovation, and the White House should insist that the proposals they come back with should have an innovation impact analysis.
Thanks, Steve. Mike?
Well, good morning. Very glad to be here, and I'll try to make my remarks very brief because I know we have a lot of very good people in the audience with lots of very good questions. As was mentioned, I've been teaching at Georgetown for about a year and a half, and one of the more interesting classes I teach is on creating a culture of innovation. And we try to look at all levels of innovation, looking at how people, individuals can become innovators, how teams can become more innovative, how companies can become more innovative, and then more interesting, how do ecosystems of innovation develop, and how do nations become more innovative. And I think this paper touches on all of those different levels, and any Office of Innovation Policy will have to do that. So that makes it a real challenge. There's so many different issues on the table here. As I said, as Rob mentioned, I've been looking at innovation and technology policy from a lot of different angles over the last 20 years, from the Senate, from the White House, from the FCC, and from IBM. And I agree wholeheartedly with Stuart and Artie that there's a major problem here, and something needs to be done. I think this is a very valuable paper in that it has stimulated a lot of discussion. Their law review paper did that, and I think by getting these ideas to a larger audience, you'll get a lot more feedback and a lot more discussion. I was very glad to see so many people here. I think they had the magic words in the title. Innovation is a very hot word right now. White House always helps. And in Washington, you double your audience if you have the word policy in there, since we're all policy wonks. I think the paper answers some fundamental questions really well, and I won't really dwell on those questions. The first is, why does innovation matter? I think they do a great job of describing what's wrong today and giving some case studies explaining what happened and why it happened that way. And I think they do a very good job of answering the question, why does the executive branch need a high-level focal point on innovation policy? And they describe some ways not to do that. I think it's very clear we don't need a Department of Innovation. It would sort of be, you'd only have two departments, the Department of Innovation and the Department of everything else, because innovation covers so many things. So it's a cross-cutting issue, and you need to have some kind of oversight, some kind of coordinating role, and I think it does make sense to do something like that out of the White House. So let me, instead of covering the questions they answered well, let's talk about some of the other questions that we really need to ask about this office or this process. One question I always ask is, what role do you really want to, what's your real goal? Is your first goal to prevent stupid things from happening? Or is your first goal to stimulate some really proactive, important new initiatives that would foster innovation? most of my career in government was devoted to the first. On my resume, I don't get to list my most important accomplishments because it's the stupid things that didn't happen because I was in the room. I think that's a very important role for this policy group, and there's a lot of policies that have been in place for far too long and a lot of proposed policies that would really stymie innovation. And if this office or this entity or this mechanism is set up properly, it can stop some of those stupid ideas early. The other big question that is explored in the paper, but I don't think we have a definitive answer, and this is going to be where we spend a lot of our time discussing the topic in the future, is what levers do you actually pull? It has to be more than hortatory, but how do you actually have an impact on agency decisions? When I was at the White House, I learned the hard way that there are two types of power in Washington: the power to do something and the power to stop something. And I thought at the White House you'd have both those types of power and lots of it. It turns out you don't have a lot of power to start something. You mostly have power to stop something. And a lot of other people in Washington have the power to stop something. So we have to figure out, if this group is going to actually launch new initiatives, how they get that power. And if you want to stop the stupid things, they also have to have some formalized process. The bully pulpit can go a long way. When I was at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, you did have the chance to stand up and talk to the press and, you know, and get something into the State of Union address to highlight an important new initiative. And you also had the chance to threaten to embarrass an agency that was doing something really stupid by letting the world know. But the question of whether you go through an IRA-like process is really important. I do think you're going to need to have some kind of process, some review process. OSTP has a function somewhat similar to what OIP is supposed to do here. OSTP is not the big, powerful entity like OMB, but it does have the ability to advise OMB and to advise the agencies and to help them understand how to do things a little bit better. Another really important question, which I don't see addressed well enough in the paper, is how do you ensure sustainability? In this administration, it's not going to be hard to get enough people paying attention to innovation policy. But there are term limits, and we don't know who's going to be in the White House in 10 years. So how do you build a structure that will continue on? Even OSTP and the Council of Economic Quality, of Environmental Quality, which are established by statute, you know, have been there a very long time, vary in their effectiveness according to what the president thinks of those organizations and their missions. So I think if we really want to address innovation policy in the long term, this has to be structured in a way that you'll have some continuity. It's not going to go away when presidential interest fades. And then the other question I open up for the audience really is, what are the best models to follow here? There's a long list of them. Stuart and Artie discussed several of them in the paper. If I can add a couple other models to consider, I would suggest that we look at what we did in the Clinton administration when we decided that information technology policy was really important. Just like innovation policy, it's a cross-cutting issue. Almost every agency was impacted, and a lot of different agencies had the ability to screw things up. And as a result, we convened something called the Information Infrastructure Task Force. And it was very high level. In most cases, it was deputy secretary level. We had 15 different agencies and a lot of independent agencies. We had a lot of the key cabinet agencies represented, as well as some of the smaller agencies. And that group really did a couple things really well. It helped agencies who were looking for support for what they wanted to do. So they could come in and get their fellow agencies to say, hey, that's really important. We really support you on that. And second, it allowed the agencies to share best practices. When I was at the White House, we did two things in this area that were really important. One was we launched the White House website, which sounds trivial, but that $300,000 investment convinced not only every agency that they needed to have a website, but a lot of CEOs and governors just had a wonderful follow-on effect. The other thing we did very early on was to revise or get rid of the Brooks Act. When we came in, it took 3 years to buy a PC because the federal government in 1993 was operating under procurement regulations that had been written more than 12 years earlier when computers were mainframes and they cost $1 million, and it might make sense to have several levels of review before you spent $5 or $10 million on a computer. Those regs were still in place when people were buying $5,000, $2,000 laptops. And so something needed to change, and this group, this task force, helped identify that as a stupid thing that needed to change. In the innovation policy arena, we've got lots of stupid things that need to change. The last question I think that needs to be answered here, and we can talk about this in the Q&A, is about the number of staff. How many people are really going to do this job? And do you put them all in the White House, or do you try to disperse the talent and have innovation and technology policy gurus scattered throughout the agencies doing a lot of the work? And I think that's probably the more sustainable model, because there's so few slots in the White House, in the OEOP, and because in the end, you really want innovation policy thinkers doing a lot of the evaluation early on in the agencies themselves. So just some thoughts to discuss in the Q&A, and again, very glad to be here and have so many people here to talk about these issues with.
Mike, thank you. I think what we'll do is we'll let Stuart and Artie just respond for just a couple of minutes, and then we'll open up for questions. I would just respond, just add a comment with regard to Steve. I thought he gave a great litany of all of the big innovation policy challenges we face in this country, and frankly, our not doing a very good job on almost none of them. My colleague Stephen Nizel has a piece coming out in the Journal of Democracy in September where we're benchmarking the top 10 countries on innovation policy, and we don't think we're one of them. But I think there are a whole set of things that have to be done. One of them, my colleague Howard Weil from Brookings and I proposed last year, creating a National Innovation Foundation akin to NSF. We need to do services innovation. We need to do patents. We need to do a whole set of things. And I see this really as just kind of a component of a broader set of national innovation and technology policy. So I don't know who, Artie or Stuart, if you want to respond.
I have a couple of things to say, and then Stuart will say a few things. So, keying off what you just said, absolutely, this is a component. We're really focusing on regulatory stuff here. Not that regulatory stuff is the only thing, but we think it's really important. Rob and Howard have talked about a National Innovation Foundation, which would focus more on the R&D side of things. These are distinct questions, but, you know, it could be that a regulatory group was located in the same place as the R&D group that that Rob has proposed. The second point that I'd like to make, I think this refers, ends up addressing both what Steve and Mike said, is that it is the case that it looks like the Obama administration has, for the most part, tended to take the, we'll disperse people who think about innovation into various agencies approach. And I think that's useful, but I do think you also need a more centralized focus. And it could be that this innovation policy group of the NEC provides that more centralized focus. I think it may be too early to tell. But of the various things that the Obama administration has done, it seems to me that the either the CTO or the innovation policy group of the NEC is what we're really talking about. It's more the centralized approach that we think is likely in the long run to be necessary, not necessarily sufficient, but at least necessary in order to get innovation policy right. Again, I'm a little concerned that the CTO and this innovation policy group of the NEC may not have the power necessary, and that's why we've looked a little bit more at the OIRA model, which, as we have noted, is very powerful. Secondly, Steve talked quite a bit about sectoral stuff and R&D in the context of various sectors. And again, looping back to the point that I made at the beginning, right now we are focused on regulation, not necessarily on R&D funding and all the stuff that's being done in various sectors in R&D, because we think regulation and innovation regulation in particular is cross-cutting across sectors. And the approaches that are used to model innovation, I think the methodology problem is a real problem. There's a lot more economists could do in terms of coming up with methodologies for modeling, for doing dynamic modeling. But that's a cross-cutting question across sectors. Stuart.
And just a couple of other notes I think are worth putting up. So yeah, our vision is that Office of Industry Policy absolutely would have the ability to prompt regulation, would be have ability to say to agencies, hey, this is something we think you should undertake. But I don't want to, if you can't see me, I'll stand. But I don't want to gainsay the importance of stopping regulation, which is, you know, so we're administrative lawyers. Sometimes the train can get going in an agency, and all of a sudden now people are starting to sign off, and a momentum gets built, and it's really something worth stopping. And the idea of OIP is that within, like, it gets in early enough that it can actually have some useful impact, and that's not to be sneezed at. That can be a very, very important role to play.
I should note here, even though I signed a brief saying that the PTO had power to do the rulemaking to which Steve referred, I think as a policy matter it was a terrible idea, and something like an OIP could have stopped it.
And then two other points. So interesting, a lot of the pushback, and maybe for the audience too, is A, how can it be sustainable? B, why don't you put them in different agencies? I think there's a tension between those two. You just put somebody in each individual agency who's in charge of innovation, it's really easy. The next administration, that position doesn't get filled, it gets forgotten about. Inertia can be your friend in Washington. Once you've got the entity created, once you've got an Office of Innovation Policy, then there's a there's sort of an embarrassment about getting rid of it. I mean, this is part of the reason why some agencies stick around long after the reason for their creation is gone. If you can get it going, then there's going to be a need to staff it. OIRA itself, there's reason to think that in the Clinton administration, they would have created an OIRA in the first place. This wasn't high on their agenda, but once it existed, they were going to have an OIRA, and it continued to serve a function. Our fear about just having it be dispersed is that's much easier for that to peter out. Having said that, if it turned out that OIP was so successful that then agencies just naturally, reflexively started taking innovation into account, and such that there could be no longer the need for OIP, great, right? This was the Leninist vision of the state, that there would be a withering away of the state once the People's Revolution had fully taken hold. Didn't work out in the Soviet Union. Certainly could work out here. I mean, seriously, it could. It could be that it becomes second nature to think about innovation in agencies, and so that you don't need to worry about it anymore. And then we'd be ecstatic to have no longer a need for an OIP. And then just one final. Last point, one other advantage I don't want to lose sight of about having an entity that does this is it's now doing this publicly. It's doing it transparently. It's actually putting forth comments that are part of the record that everybody sees is out there. And I think that there's a value to that, both from the standpoint of the public, but again, also from the standpoint of judicial review. When courts later come in, did you take these comments seriously? But anyway, I want to get the question, so I'll desist.
Another quick point on that is to think about the analogy to OIRA. Every agency has an economist, actually Greg Tassinger, who's involved in the NIST economist role, and we have CEA. So we shouldn't really need cost-benefit analysis under that logic, because agencies should do this on their own, and CEA should do it. But obviously we do, because we've had to put it in place. So. Let's go for comments or questions. If you can raise your hand and first identify yourself, I see Howard. So Howard, you go first, and then we'll go here.
Yeah, I'm Howard Weil from the Brookings Institution. One of the most important ways that the Obama administration has intervened in industries in ways that will have potentially enormous impact on innovation, for better or worse, but really you're not thinking about it in those terms at all, is really below the regulatory level, where you have statutes and regulations that give decision makers very broad discretion, and then they go and use it. Example A, the auto industry task force. Example B, the Treasury's approach to the banking industry. Do you imagine your OIP having any role in those kinds of interventions?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that I would think, although I haven't followed closely what the Obama administration has been doing with respect to the financial industry. I would think that in the auto industry in particular, there would be a huge role for thinking about innovation, and I suspect that there probably has not been much thinking about innovation in the way the auto industry is being restructured. The financial industry is a little more tricky because in some respects, the financial innovations that the industry created were sufficiently risky that they created problems of their own. So innovation sometimes is not, you know, you have to balance off the pluses and the minuses and the risks that innovation can create, which is something we talk about a lot in our paper, but certainly in the auto industry, yeah.
Right here.
Yes. My name is Robert Caldwell, and I've had a long-time history with federal health care, which you were addressing earlier. And I also have been looking for mechanisms of innovation and found a couple to use. What's interesting to me is, while you all are talking about legislative approaches, what this new office may be, what I'm curious about is, have you considered unleashing the power within the government itself, where I've been able to use a mechanism to get people to come forth and to make their contributions for innovations. Bureaucracies basically are such an environment that they kind of tamp down innovation, that they really look at it as, when they tamp it down, they reduce risk, they give some better control over the budget, and they see innovation quite as threatened. So while we may use a mechanism to bring something about, which we've done several times now, the overall culture which you all were addressing is such that even though it exists within the government quite readily and people really want to come forward, they are afraid to step up to it, and basically the agency policies are such that innovation is not deemed to be discussed or brought forth. So what I'm asking, are you looking at a way to unleash the power within the government currently?
I think it's a great question. And right, part of the hope of an OIP is, right, there are people in every agency who really care about this. And they just aren't often listened to by people hired. And one advantage of an OIP, especially sort of in a prompt function, is in effect it can give them greater voice. It doesn't necessarily know who they are. Doesn't need to know who they are necessarily, right? This can be a new consideration now for the heads of agencies, such that they might take more seriously those people who are in the agency who care about this, right? We all know there are a ton of people in every agency who are kind of beating their heads against a wall, saying, you know, why won't those people on the top floor listen to me? Having this entity out there, now an outside force pushing the agencies, we think can therefore lead the heads to say, well, maybe we should actually look more seriously now at what these various people in the agencies are interested in.
That's certainly what happened with the web back in the early 90s. And you pull the deputy secretary into the White House and say, what are you doing about the web? Suddenly the 28-year-old webmaster becomes important.
Right.
The deputy secretary. And Y2K was another great example, uh-huh, where there was a White House office. It got all the agencies mobilized. There was a point person in each agency, often within each part of each agency, that had to do something about Y2K. And this mm-hmm could be the catalytic effect that this focal point could provide.
I mean, and one last point on that. You know, I'm an agency head, and I feel like I've got a set of marching orders from the world, my world really being the statute and what I understand to be, you know, the political considerations, etc. You add in a new marching order that seems to be taken seriously, and my perspective changes a little bit.
Ken, and then here.
Stand up so you can hear me. Ken Jarbo. In my checkered past, I both was a staffer who oversaw OIRA back in the dark ages, cost benefit analysis, and was the author of the ill-fated competitiveness impact statement provision. When we were doing those efforts, the model we always fell back on was the environmental impact statement. And it seemed that the real power there came not from OIRA or from the White House or from CDQ, it came from the courts. Mm. So could you talk about how you see the role of judicial review in here? And isn't there an alternative to do something similar to that, where you go in and change the organic statute, put in the mission statement? I mean, we had to do this with the National Labs, literally change the Atomic Energy Act to make tech transfer part of the mission of the National Labs, change the mission statement, put in a reporting requirement, and then allow the courts to be the power to enforce it.
Right, so we've given a lot of thought to this. So first things first. if there's any congressional staff, we'd be overjoyed if Congress tomorrow wanted to change all the organic acts, or even just one simple act. Now, every agency should consider innovation as one of its components. Having said that, it's a harder route to take just politically. That's a tougher thing to achieve to get that kind of momentum. First, the concern is, again, some of those statements we know are just ignored. EISs have worked fairly well, environmental impact statements, and as you noted, some of them they aren't even made, or if they're made, they're sort of utterly ignored. But this is where our boring background as administrative lawyers is relevant. So, as you may know, whenever any argument is brought before an agency, it is supposed to take a hard look at the good arguments that are put before it. Now, how is that hard look given any teeth? Because the courts will then review the agency and say, well, look, this really good point was made in a comment to you, and you didn't respond to it in any way, and therefore we're going to send this back. Your order is arbitrary and capricious. We're going to send it back. You have to reconsider your decision in light of this good comment. You can still reach the same outcome, but you have to tell us why it is you rejected the views that were put forward by this player. And that hard look review has a lot of teeth. Agencies get frustrated because they think sometimes it has too much, too much power. We think of that as being a very significant element of what we're proposing, because agencies will ignore what OIP says at their litigation peril, and they'll know that. And they'll know that a court may well say, wait a minute, this point was made about this other route you could have taken. Why didn't you look at that more seriously? Tell us the way in which you took a hard look at this and considered this. Sorry.
Quickly.
Does it have to be a government agency, though? I mean, if it's a hard look, it can come from anything. Maybe, Rob, here's a niche for IPIF to putting in comments and then going to the courts and saying, you didn't take into consideration these comments about how it affects innovation. Can it be an outside party?
Absolutely. Anybody's comments can be subject to the hard look review. We just frankly think the OIPs will be taken more seriously by courts because they're institutional role. But anybody's comments, I encourage Rob to set up a comment writing shop.
If you guys do like this pro bono thing, you could do this all
right, exactly.
You know, infinite free time.
Right. If somebody wants to fund us to do it, it's because you know, we could think about it.
I think there was a question right here, and then
we'll go to Patrick. Emily Sapensky with IEEE USA. I share my concerns about sustainability and yours about an organization within the federal government for this kind of thing, especially within your paper. You say innovation is highly cumulative, and here you are proposing establishing an agency out of the blue, in the middle, with policy wonks or policy geeks, I don't know. Is that the best way to go with innovation? Somehow the definition of innovation, maybe you have something that's firmer that will supply the right people for this office, or as you suggest, something outside, like a foundation.
So I think there are at least two questions in your question. One is, how are we defining innovation? That's a really good question. I mean, it seems to me that is a hard question to answer. There are no clear bounds to what innovation means. And we also have to distinguish innovation policy from science and technology policy, which is what OSTP does. We define innovation as the development and deployment of technological improvements. Now, you could say, well, technology is also very hard to define. What does technology mean? For the most part, right now, we're going to be focusing on stuff that is core technology, IT, healthcare, biopharmaceutical stuff, I totally agree with Steve that the pharmaceutical innovation standstill is something that hugely needs to be addressed. Green tech, we don't need to worry about whether, right now at least, whether credit default swaps constitute innovation. We're not going to go there at this point. The second point that I think you're making is, well, why aren't we building upon stuff that's come before? Innovation is cumulative. Shouldn't regulatory interventions also be cumulative? And I think we are. I think we're looking at the model of OIRA. We're looking at what the Obama administration has already done. We're not proposing something that would be a radical remaking of the state by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, one objection we've gotten is this is so modest. You know, shouldn't we be doing something much more dramatic? And certainly from academics, most people think this is the most boring thing ever. So I think we are being cumulative. We're really trying hard to look at what's gone before, what people have already done.
You're creating a new office.
I mean, one of the things about nomenclature is that we are not committed to the particular nomenclature that we have. So it could be within OIRA, it could be, frankly, it could be within OSTP or some other entity, so long as it had the power to remand regulation and its comments became part of the hard look review. So we could create we could add innovation to the OSTP mission, for example. So it's not necessarily, and this goes to some of the staffing questions, it's not necessarily a huge expenditure of people, in terms of people or resources. So I know in D.C. nomenclature tends to become quite important, but we're not wedded to our nomenclature by any stretch. We're wedded to the powers that the entity would have.
And just one other point about continuity. Right, there isn't much continuity because this hasn't really been on the agenda. So sort of by definition, if you want to put something new on the agenda that hasn't really been there, you're going to get the question of, what are you building off of? And the answer is, what we're building off of right now is very fragmented and, you know, very hortatory. You know, a lot of people who can sort of engage in jawboning in a variety of ways. And yes, this is an attempted step from there. There's just no two ways about it.
I think Patrick, and then here, and then here.
All right. Thanks, Rob. Fascinating paper.
Patrick, you want to identify yourself?
Oh yeah, Patrick Ross, Copyright Alliance. Fascinating paper. Anything that cites Paul Romer, Joseph Schumpeter, and Rob Atkinson is worth reading. Put that out there. Two things I'm a little confused about. One is, you talk about a formal relationship of the executive office of the president within the rulemaking process at the FCC. That's an independent agency, not part of the administration, and reports to Congress. So I'm not sure logistically how that works or if people would view that as a threat. Also, both of you did introduce into the discussion the broadcast flag debate, and both of you said that there were lots of alternatives that maybe this organization could have pursued on piracy, so I'm curious what some of those would have been.
So, I mean, just focus on the first, and this is where I recognize we will probably may offend some people in the room, so, you know, so be it. So, as a constitutional matter, we're both fairly confident that the president would have the constitutional authority to say, we're going to ask agencies to send this to send what they're doing to OIP or anybody else, and OIP is going to comment. We see absolutely no constitutional problem with that. Now, is there a political problem with it? I think there's a political problem with it if you can block. If an OIP can say, this can't go forward, which is the role that I don't actually think that there's going to be a massive political problem with doing this. No, it's not the position that the FCC is accustomed to being in. If worse comes to worst and there has to be a softer form of OIP involvement in the FCC, that's not that big a deal to us. Frankly, a lot of their important input is going to be at the policy formulation stage, giving comments to another agency. That happens all the time. The NTIA all the time is talking to the FCC. The FCC doesn't say, we refuse to hear, you know, we will throw everything back over the transom that you send to us. I mean, it's, you know, and so there's no reason to think that this couldn't work, you know, sort of similarly well to that.
And in fact, our empirical data suggests that the FCC listens more to the NTIA than to any other commentator. We've done empirical research on this.
Right. This is right. It turns out, for better or for worse, comments. I bet no one in this room is surprised to hear this. Comments from individuals to agencies are almost universally ignored, and the comments that agencies are often most responsive to is other entities. They just have more clout. Even have more clout than than the various lobbying groups. As to the broadcast flag, I don't, having introduced it, I don't want to go, in part because things have even changed since then, I sort of don't want to go too far down that. The point is simply this. There were other ways of trying to protect the content that weren't going to force device manufacturers to completely remake their devices.
I was just curious what those were.
Right. So, well, so one.
Why don't we do that?
Okay.
You two after.
Okay. Offline. Okay. Right.
Well, I do want to get a couple more questions. Gary, and then over here.
Gary, Rob, in deference to your point about your forthcoming study on where the U.S. ranks in innovation, Mike and others, but your ISOC relationship, where does international relations fit into this?
Yeah.
Where will the relationship be, since so much innovation is coming from around the world?
Do you want me to take that? And could you be a little more specific on what you mean by international relations? I mean, do you you mean like
technology or science or agriculture, energy, something that comes from elsewhere beyond State Department relationships, where OIP will have a role?
Will OIP, for instance, have a role in determining the U.S. government's position going into a treaty negotiation?
This is one of the
questions I didn't get to. So
I see.
Or immigration regulation.
Good. Yes. So these are great questions. So, yes, I mean, obviously immigration has, and treaties can have huge impacts on innovation. And it would have the proactive role that we were talking about. There wouldn't be a regulatory, or I suppose in the context of the INS, there could, or not, it's no longer the INS, there could be regulatory commentary it could make, but certainly in the context of treaties, for example, its role would be more proactive. And there, frankly, the proactive role is more hortatory because there is no public record being created prior to the regulation or whatever sort of statement that is made publicly. Prior to that, there's no public record. And so yes, it would have a role, but that role would be more hortatory.
One could make an argument that USTR doesn't really take innovation as seriously as they could. And this would be a way to do that. Gentleman right here.
Yeah, Todd Dickinson, American IP Law Association. Technology sectors often vary wildly, sometimes aggressively, in how they view certain types of innovation policy. Intellectual property is an example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Biopharma has very extremely strong protection to protect their business model. The contact information technology might be on the other end of the spectrum. How do you see this agency or the office reconciling those various?
So I see that question as a real softball because it's a perfect place for an OIP to come in and say, hey guys, there are positions that could serve both of your interests. There are ways of setting up, for example, continuation rules, which are the rules that were so dramatically opposed by, in particular, BioPharm, differently, so that BioPharm won't hate them and IT can still live with them. And so it seems to me that one of the difficulties we've seen in both the regulatory context and in the congressional debate is that there's very little leadership right now being provided by a neutral government entity. The PTO does have an economist, but that office has not been filled yet. And so it seems to me that in the context of a lot of these IP debates in particular, an OIP that was perceived as being objective could serve a mediating function and show that there are ways to resolve these debates without coming down on one side or the other, but having neutral positions that take into account the interests of all industries.
OMB had those rules as continuation rules mm-hmm. before it.
Right.
Chose not to intervene despite enormous pressure.
Right. And I think that because OMB doesn't really think about innovation, I don't think it cared that much about those rules, even though it should have. And if you talk to David Boundy about this, David Boundy is somebody who's complained and actually submitted comments to OMB about their new regulatory review process, saying that you guys really messed up in the continuation rule context. And I think they did.
We have time for two more questions. Kevin Finner, Issues in Science and Technology at the National Academies. I'm wondering, you look back at OIRA as a kind of starting point for the discussion, and when we talk about a new agency, you know, Steve pointed out we don't have metrics or standards by which to measure innovation. Mike pointed out that often government just doesn't spur innovation but prevents bad ideas that could stop innovation.
I wonder, when you look back at OIRA and you think about people, John Graham, Susan Dudley, and what they did with an ideology of getting government out of the way of innovation, and what someone like Cass Sunstein might do with the NUCHA approach to innovation, what might be accomplished within OIRA? I mean, because all of us know that when you talk about a new agency, you create lots of trouble, and turf wars, and all sorts of things. So I just wonder, within OIRA, what a different, someone like Sunstein, what he might do that was different, what he could and could not do within that type of structure.
So I know Cass Sunstein. Cass Sunstein is a friend of mine. No, he's not actually, but I do know him. And I do hope that part of this is a message to Cass Sunstein and the folks at OIRA to take innovation into account. Now, I'm pleased to say that about 10 of the comments, of the 175 comments that were submitted to OIRA in the context of the regulatory review it's doing right now of its own regulatory order, EO 12866, which is the order under which it operates to review cost-benefit analysis that agencies do. There were a lot of comments on lots of different things, including whether it should apply to independent agencies. Lots of stuff came up in that process, but at least 10 people talked about innovation and the fact that OIRA analysis doesn't take innovation into account, and I'm really hoping that those sorts of comments, at a minimum, will get into the process, and that's a very extremely low-cost way of getting thinking about innovation going in a very powerful a regulatory context.
Right, but this is also where, just very quickly, where the sustainability point comes in.
It's
right. Cass is much smarter than I am. This would be a great thing if he does it, but that's an easy thing. The next OIRA administrator comes in and doesn't focus on it, and it just gets forgotten.
No. I mean, you set up a new office.
Oh, no. I'm sorry.
What I'm saying is, I mean, I think you're going to be much more sustainable if OIRA have this function, because the boss is going to hire some permanent civil servants who will sit at OMB and will be there in the next administration and maybe the one after that. Most offices at the White House, OSTP is a good example, turn over almost entirely. Some of the people are permanent civil servants, but they're on loan from agencies, and they often go back. So it's if you brought continuity, put it at OMB and put it in the agencies, because those people are there for the long term, and you can hire really good people who can do the analysis year in and year out, and they'll provide an institution for you.
Yeah, and we do talk about putting the OIP within OIRA. I think that would be like having a cadre of five, you know, a SWAT team, essentially, of five people who did dynamic analysis that included innovation would be fantastic, because I don't think they have anything like that right now.
By the way, I wanted to raise the question of lack of methodology. And I wanted to underscore that I don't think that's necessarily a fundamental objection. I suspect that if one, and I'm not an expert, if one looked at the history of OIRA, there's lots of debate about the methodology, which undoubtedly some of it still continues, but there's been an evolution, and this might be positive for the development of a methodology to analyze innovation.
Right. I should say that of the 175 comments or so, almost all of them, all 175, had some criticism of current cost-benefit methodology. And of course, you're going to have criticisms of methodology, and that's
but there
part
has been
of the evolution.
But Steve is right.
And there's definitely been progress, yeah.
I think on that note, one could argue that demand creates its own supply, and we would see that occurring. There's no demand for that kind of analysis, and so there's less willingness to do supply. We've gone over by 1 minute, so we need to stop. They'll be here for a few minutes. I'd like to thank Steve and Mike in particular for great comments, and Artie and Stuart. So please join me in thanking them.